A few years ago, The New Yorker ran a cartoon that pictured people streaming joyously out of a traditional-looking church building, as I know each of you do every Sunday morning after being here. And each of the many congregants had one of those giant foam fingers, I think they're often yellow, that you sometimes see at sporting events. On their hand, that has the index finger raised, indicating the number one. And in case you didn't get that, they usually have number one emblazoned on them as well, you know, sticking out 3 or 4 feet in the air. So all of these congregants streaming from the building all had these yellow, you know, emblazoned number one hands raised in the air proudly. And the caption read, "It's true. We totally have the best religion." And in contrast to this idea that any one religion could be the best, or even that best is an appropriate theological category, you heard in our spoken meditation from Peter Morales, the president of the UU Association, that he's one of many people advocating that a new interfaith, multi-faith spirituality is struggling to be born. And importantly, he adds that I'm convinced that we Unitarian Universalists have a historic opportunity to help create that future. Not that we'll do it alone, but that we're in a place to help catalyze and help it. And from my perspective, there are at least two reasons that is the case. First, Unitarian Universalism is explicitly multi-faith, and we have been since our onset in the early 60s. Whereas the word interfaith is often used to indicate dialogue between individuals or groups who are rooted in separate traditions, so like a Christian dialoguing with a Muslim, or a Buddhist dialoguing with a Hindu, or a Sikh dialoguing with the Jew. So there's these sort of siloed religions that are stepping out of their silo to dialogue with each other. That's interfaith often. A multi-faith path seeks to be rooted in multiple perspectives, to smash down some walls and say, do these really need to be here? And we UUs draw from 6 broad sources. Again, they're on the back of your order of service. Direct experience, the words and deeds of prophetic men and women, wisdom from the world's traditions. We list explicitly the Jewish and Christian traditions because that's some of that liberal Protestant heritage that UUism comes out of. Humanist teachings, religion and science, and earth-centered traditions that we mentioned this morning with the equinox. Now, a critic might ask, is it really possible to be rooted in multiple perspectives? For one response, we could turn the clock back 150 years to quote our transcendentalist forebear, Walt Whitman, from his poem Song of Myself, where he writes, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes." I love that answer. It's generous, robust, expansive, open, playful. But for those of you who are here for my sermon a few weeks ago on building your own theology, you'll recall that a more negative criticism would be that we UUs are often just theologically promiscuous. The word promiscuity, of course, has all those connotations of being indiscriminate, transient, casual. But that pejorative characterization does not have to be the case with a healthy, multi-faith perspective or practice. In my experience of moving from a progressive Christian context to a Unitarian Universalist context, there's a paradigm shift that happens when you move from interfaith to multi-faith. From dialogue between 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or more different traditions to one tradition that seeks to fully embrace multiple traditions. And I'll freely confess, however, that one of the greatest temptations for most multi-faith individuals and communities is to stay in the shallow end of the pool. I'll grant that. To dip our toes in the various world religions without ever taking a plunge into the deep end of full, immersive, extended experience. You know, a minute of silence, that's okay, but Saturday morning, 4 hours of meditation for a Buddhist retreat, not so sure about that. You know, that would just be one example. But I think the risk of this potential temptation to only stay in the shallow end of the pool in a multi-faith setting, I think that risk is worth it. For example, I've spent much time in Christian circles, and I've heard so many criticisms like, you know, going to church doesn't make you a Christian any more than being in a garage makes you a car. You hear stuff like that all the time. Indeed, loving God, loving your neighbor, and loving your enemies, that's what makes you more Christ-like, and that's what's vexing some Roman Catholics when all of a sudden the Pope is actually doing and saying some things more like what Jesus would say. I suspect there's similar criticisms in other traditions, such as buying expensive Buddhist paraphernalia is unlikely to contribute to your enlightenment directly or immediately. Spending time meditating with your butt on the cushion is much more likely to contribute to the awakening that Buddhists seek. Or even just taking, if last week's opening hymn or this week's opening hymn of metta, loving kindness, or Tonglen, giving and receiving, if that really resonated with you, even spending a minute or 5 minutes or in the middle of the day, if your boss or your child or your coworker or your partner is causing stress and anxiety, to say, you know, for myself, I wish you well, being at peace. For this person, I wish them well. Or I breathe in peace, I breathe out love. Spending some time can return you to a more centered, open, generous, compassionate place. But I have immense respect, all that being said, for my friends who are called to walk in mostly Buddhist circles or Christian circles or pagan circles or secular humanist circles, and who go deeply into those traditions in open-minded, compassionate ways. But from what I've seen, there are approximately the same number of dabblers in circles that are essentially or exclusively Buddhist, Christian, pagan, humanist, as there are dabblers in multi-faith circles. Likewise, there are approximately the same number of hardcore adherents. I suspect this is the case because all of those various different groups, whether exclusive, interfaith, multifaith, are all composed of human beings with all the same foibles, weaknesses, and good intentions that aren't always accompanied by ideal follow-through. So that being the case, if I were asked to choose my preferred default setting, I would choose multifaith over interfaith every time. I see our pluralistic age as an invitation to have more religious communities where the starting point is multi-faith and interspiritual. I'll get to that word in a second if you're not sure what it means. Similarly, when I think about the religious context in which I'd like to raise any hypothetical children that Megan and I may one day have, or likely will one day have, I see a great strength in those hypothetical children learning from day one, as well as the non-hypothetical children that are back in religious education right now, learning from day one to move naturally, easily, authentically, even simultaneously between multiple religious experiences and perspectives. If you come to my social media class, I'll show you a YouTube clip of a 2-year-old deftly navigating an iPhone. And I think that that's the sort of world. You know, we're now birthing children that are coming into a wired world where they're learning to do, you know, navigate iPhones and iPads naturally. And that's what I want to be the natural default setting. Children coming into the world and having multi-faith interspirituality be their natural default setting and starting point. And I see that potential as a tremendous asset in our postmodern world, akin to growing up speaking multiple languages. It's also essential for me to highlight the ingredient that I think makes all the difference in whether one stays at the shallow end of the pool or occasionally risks diving into the deep end. And this ingredient that makes all the difference, whether we're talking about a single tradition or a multi-faith setting, is what we UUs call the first source. Direct experience. What you know is true because you've experienced it in the crucible of your own direct experience. More than 300 years ago, George Fox, founder of the Society of Friends, commonly known as the Quakers, said it this way. You will say that Christ said this, or the disciples said this, but what canst thou say? And I take his meaning to be that he was exasperated with his fellow 17th century preachers who were constantly quoting the Bible but seemed to have no authentic experience of their own. Fox's point was that whatever ancient biblical figures or other figures from other scriptures, whatever they experienced of God, reality, the Spirit, that's also available for us today. Just like with science, you can say, you don't just have to believe Copernicus and Galileo. Go look in the telescope. Go look under the microscope. You can experience it firsthand for yourself. And the corollary is that whatever we can't replicate today likely didn't happen either then, because we all live in the same morality. That wasn't some magical fable time 2,000 years ago. It's the same reality, and whatever was possible then is also possible now. And either way, Fox's argument, and I agree, is that experiencing a truth firsthand for yourself makes all the difference, as opposed to reading about it secondhand in a book. Now, I should also add that all firsthand experiences, of course, are not equally helpful. Directly experiencing intolerance, bigotry, and cruelty is helpful only to the extent that it motivates you to work for greater love, greater compassion, and greater kindness in the world. From a more positive angle, I invite you to consider that in a multi-faith context, such as a Unitarian Universalist congregation, firsthand experiences that may be the most helpful are what are sometimes called interspiritual experiences. And some of you may recall my sermon about a month ago called Why Spiritual and Religious is More Radical Than Spiritual But Not Religious. And in that sermon, I offered the working definition that religion is about institutions and community, whereas spirituality is about firsthand experience. And my contention is that we desperately need both. Individuals who really know truth firsthand for themselves and that truth lived out in community, which amplifies and helps keep those experiences honest. We need both if we're going to have the greatest chance of transforming this world for the better. And related to this distinction between religion and spirituality, interspirituality is a word coined in 1999 by the late Wayne Teasdale in his book, The Mystic Heart. Interspirituality emphasizes shared experiences of heart and unity consciousness. For Unitarian Universalists, inner spirituality is where our six sources meet our seventh principle, the interdependent web of all existence. But not just the idea intellectually of an interdependent web, but the existential, realized, firsthand experience of experiencing yourself as part of an interdependent web of all existence. That's heart and unity consciousness. And all the world's religions have paths and practices for experiencing heartfulness, mindfulness, and the unity of those two experiences, as well as adherents who have realized the heights and depths of the human experience. But here's an open secret that is too little discussed. All the world's religions originated from founders who had experienced heart and unity consciousness with the interdependent web. No, they didn't call it that, but I'll call it that. But tragically, too many of their followers, or sometimes the founders themselves, over time, corrupted the original authentic insight for their own profit, for their own gain. In Buddhist parlance, they would say, we too often mistake the finger pointing at the moon for the moon itself. In other words, we humans have historically wasted way too much time arguing about what was said and done by Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, etc. But all those historic religious figures are just metaphorical fingers pointing at us toward the metaphorical moon, which in this analogy represents God, gods, reality, spirit, whatever your preferred term is. And the essential lesson from each of those figures is that whatever goodness, truth, revelation they experienced is also accessible and possible for us today, or else it's probably more fiction than fact. But lest we get too eager in jettisoning traditional claims of religious experience, remember that contemporary figures such as Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Dorothy Day, Thich Nhat Hanh, Aung San Suu Kyi, and many others challenge us that much more is possible about our firsthand experience and in community than we often allow. Those figures challenge us to dive into the deep end of life, to see if it might be possible to experience heart and unity consciousness, deep interconnectedness with all that we meet, with one another, with this earth, even with the whole cosmos. How we treat one another and how we treat this world really matters. Last week during the benediction, I shared that the Roman Catholic monk Thomas Merton, who was deeply invested in interfaith dialogue with Buddhist monks, he had an unexpected experience of the interdependent web of all existence while standing in, of all places, while waiting to cross the street at the intersection of 4th and Walnut in Louisville, Kentucky. Now 4th and Muhammad Ali Boulevard, if any of you are in Louisville and want to find it. And he wrote the following in his private journal on March 19th, 1958. And I think we need to pay attention to that. These aren't all these claims are not things that happened, you know, all 2,000 years ago. There are people making these claims today, and the test is in the fruit of how they live their life. He wrote the following in his private journal, again, on March 19th, 1958. Yesterday in Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, suddenly realized that I loved all these people, and that none of them were or could be totally alien to me, as if waking from a dream of separateness. He later added in his book, Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, "Then it was if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts. The depths of their hearts were neither sin, nor desire, nor self-knowledge can reach the core of their identity. The person that each one is in God's eyes, if only they could see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time, there would be no more war, hatred, cruelty, greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other." For those here last week, Merton's unitive experience in as mundane a place as standing on a random street corner is akin to David Foster Wallace's attempt to realize his interconnectedness in the frustrating context of a slow-moving grocery line after a long workday. But in both examples, that's precisely where heart and unity consciousness make all the difference. Not in the abstract, not up on a mountaintop where it's easy to feel connected with everyone and nature. What matters is living out of that heart and unity consciousness in how we treat our family members, how we treat our friends, our coworkers every day, when we're operating out of a place not of stress, independence, and separateness, but out of compassion, interdependentness, and connectedness. And in comparing Merton and Wallace, I would also qualify that I'm not saying that all numinous experiences are exactly the same across world religions. There are important distinctions between what you could call Christian illumination, union, Christ consciousness, or gnosis, secret knowledge, Buddhist nibbana, satori, or kensho, which are various words about enlightenment, Jain kavalayana, absolute knowledge, Hindu moksha, or ultimate freedom, Islamic Sufi ma'arifat, ultimate knowledge, or fana fi Allah, which is annihilation, or Jewish Kabbalistic Ein Sof, which is oneness. For humanists, one equivalent might be the equivalent that some people derive from the rapturous awe that can be experienced from living a life aware that we are made from the same raw materials as the stars. As one writer put it, we are stardust evolved to the point where stars can think about themselves. We are the universe becoming conscious of itself. We are stardust that has begun to contemplate the stars. And for each of these various perspectives I have listed, there are important distinctions. But interspirituality chooses to emphasize the similarities as equally important, if not more important, than the differences. Along these lines, one of my favorite Buddhist teachers is Daniel Ingram. He gave a fascinating talk at the 2012 Buddhist Geeks Conference. You can go to it. It happens every year. Titled, "It's a Jungle in There." And one of his central points was that contemplatives need to learn from the 19th century naturalists and taxonomists who brought incredibly extensive, meticulous, rigorous approaches of observation, analysis to the natural world, the external natural world. And Ingram's assertion, and the good news is some of this is already starting to happen, is that we need to apply the same, to the extent that's possible, scientific approaches to our interior life, to our subjective experiences that we brought to the external world in the 19th century with Darwin and others. And although there will inevitably be aspects of our inner subjective experience that can't be studied in precisely the same way that we study the external world, we've got some pretty fancy technology out there with MRIs and CAT scans that we can do some pretty incredible things that weren't possible before the 21st century. And there's much to be gained from bringing the powerful lens of science to bear on religious experience. One hope is it could help us better understand the ways that anatomy, neurochemistry, how that can help us separate what works in achieving union, gnosis, enlightenment, etc., and what are merely historical and cultural trappings that we can let go of if they aren't helpful to us. And my hope is that President Morales is right, that UUs are poised to be at the forefront of helping contribute to what does and does not help and aid experiences of cultivating heart and unity consciousness in our pluralistic, postmodern, multipolar world. So I hope at least one takeaway from this sermon is that whether you're a UU humanist, UU Buddhist, UU Christian, UU pagan, or another tradition, I encourage you to pay attention to the people, places, and activities that make you feel fully alive and fully, deeply interconnected to the world around you. Give yourself permission to take advantage of opportunities to go deep into those experiences and maybe to let go of some of those people, places, activities that leave you feeling isolated, ungrateful, and disconnected. Dive in with a full heart and an open mind. That may mean coming early once or twice a month for some of our UU Christian, UU Buddhist, or Earth-centered services, or staying late for a discussion with some of your fellow UU humanists. It might look like signing up this morning to be part of a Chalice community, to share your journey over the next few months with fellow travelers. For others, it might look like a commitment to a weekly or daily yoga practice, or simply taking time to reconnect with nature on a leisurely walk. For now, I'll leave you with one final thought. Some of you may have seen in the news that the shooter at the Navy Yard was a Buddhist. I'm not saying that his Buddhism is what caused him to commit this tragic act. That doesn't appear to be the case. But rather, I see this as the latest tragic example that an adherent of any religion or non-religion can be peaceful or violent, healthy or unhealthy, depending on the maturity and the personal history of the specific individual or community in question. From an inverse perspective, one Muslim theologian has asked provocatively that does the example of Rumi, that 13th century Sufi Islamic mystic poet, does the example of Rumi suggest that the deeper the holiness of a Muslim, the greater the possibility that that Muslim will be a pluralist? That's a beautiful idea from the perspective of inner spirituality. And as a whole, we UUs love thinking about the different possibilities in this world. We love ideas. And the old joke is if there were an afterlife and UUs were asked to choose between going to heaven or debating about heaven, that we would choose debating about heaven over eternal bliss, and that maybe eternal bliss is eternal debate for some UUs. But inner spirituality invites us to let go of our preconceived notions, to open not only our minds, but our hearts, to feeling our interconnectedness with one another, with this one earth, and with this entire cosmos, all made of the same material. We are stardust, become aware of itself. And from this inner spiritual perspective, I leave you with this poem from Rumi, that 13th century inner spiritual Muslim. Out beyond ideas. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and of rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. Out beyond ideas, I'll meet you there.